The Creative Writer's Way.
Writing is fundamental. It is our way. From stories come history. From history comes belonging. From belonging comes a sense of where we were, where we are, and where we are going. This is the foundation of civilization.
This is Dr. Schuyler Madison. Find your story at schuylermadison.com. This is Dr. Schuyler Madison Fontana and the Creative Writer's Way. Today, I have the pleasure of talking with Jim Lee, an investment manager who focuses on the analysis of emerging technology, social trends, and also the author of Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life. And I can't think of a more important mindset than resilience at a time when resilience is probably more important than ever today. Welcome, James. Are you there?
It's wonderful to be here. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. And just to start off, would you mind giving us a little bit about your backstory and how you were called to do what you do?
Sure. So I have a few different designations under my belt. I started out as financial planner back in 1990-91. I did that for a few years and just continued to grow and develop. I was actually at a college reunion at William & Mary, which is where I went to school, and I was standing around for one of those group pictures. And I asked one of my colleagues what he did for a living. He said that he was a professional futurist, which I thought was just the coolest thing ever. And given the choice of getting an MBA or going to graduate school to become a futurist, that was a no-brainer for me. I decided to become a futurist.
Love it.
There's just one university in the U.S. which offers a graduate degree in foresight. That is in the University of Houston, where my wife was doing her residency in medicine. So they graduate, at this point, probably a dozen or two futurists per year. And that's where I went to school to become a futurist.
That is so cool. I've never even heard of that as a potential thing that one studies.
It's a thing. Yeah, it is a thing. And it's a small crowd because there's something called the Association of Professional Futurists. There are about 500 worldwide that are in this group. And if you are a futurist, you run the risk of knowing everyone else in the business in the U.S. because there's just not that many of us.
So could you define futurist and, how would we kind of, process that?
So it's a discipline. It's called strategic foresight, and that's really the process of using what we know about the future to make better decisions today. And I just happen to apply that to the financial planning process. So generally speaking, there are three different types of futures that we study. There's the probable future, which is really about forecasting, which is what you think is going to happen. There is the possible future, which is what could happen, okay? And then there is the preferred future, which is what you want to happen, okay? So the whole goal is to be able to get the preferred future the same as the probable future. That's your future. Every future comes with its own toolbox. Whether you're doing regression analysis for forecasting, whether you're doing scenario planning for possible futures, or whether you're doing visioning work, which gets a little bit more creative to think about the future you would want to have. Okay. So that's it sort of in a nutshell. I spent a lot of time doing forecasting. That's kind of my thing. But my book that I wrote a few years ago was really about looking at the upside of the financial crisis to figure out how people are adapting to an environment of economic uncertainty. So that's what resilience was about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're going to get into that, more. But I just one of the things that struck me about what you said, you used the term regression analysis and visionary work. And when I had my wellness center in New York, I use those two modalities in terms of working with people to help them clear their past and move forward to bring into fruition what their vision was. So I just was struck by, those terms in terms of that's what I used to do with individuals.
Well, it's interesting. Regression analysis is actually a mathematical process, but I did an elective in visionary futures and actually published a paper a few years ago. It ended up being somewhat controversial on remote viewing the future, which is very visionary, which is where you are looking forward. And I used a lot of the techniques developed by the Army in their Stargate program and looked at how to look at things that haven't happened yet. And that was a little woo-woo, but really fun. Really fun, and I think kind of useful, too.
So that's so funny that you mentioned that, too, because I'm also a budding storyteller, and I'm always on the lookout for story ideas. And one of the things that had fascinated me in the past was remote viewing. You know, I have a whole section, you know, in my bookcase on that in terms of putting that into a story, because there have been some conspiracies about that as well. So it's so funny how, you know, there's just overlap that you never would have expected, right?
Right, right,
So you encourage people to look beyond the gloom and doom, and because these emotions are obviously not empowering ones. And in a story, a story will take the protagonist to a point of gloom and doom, what we call the dark night of the soul. And it's at that point that the character transforms and is usually able to learn the skill to overcome whatever the crisis was.
So, hero's journey.
We need to take this advice and in some way embody this quality. So talk to me a little bit about resilience.
So as a futurist, we look at a lot of different scenarios. You have best case scenarios and you have worst case scenarios. And one of the things that you find out fairly easy early is that it's really easy to come up with a very compelling and convincing and descriptive worst-case scenario, okay? And people just kind of gravitate into that, and it's very believable and very moving and very natural. And it's actually really hard to come up with a compelling best-case scenario. Okay, really sort of think about, you know, utopian futures. Right now, you read science fiction, you watch the movies, it's all dystopian. It's always when things go wrong. And it's hard to come up with a compelling narrative of when things come right. And I've always had an interest in utopian literature. And I actually lived in America's oldest running utopian community for a year. And it's here in Delaware. It's called Arden. And it was started during the arts and crafts era of the 1800s. And it was sort of a commune built on a farm where nobody owned land. They had land rents as sort of a single tax system. And even today, it has about 2,000 or 3,000 households, a flourishing community. And that was a vision that went right, you know. So Very cool. So my book on resilience was written shortly after the financial crash, and it was really beginning to look like the wheels were going to fall off the wagon. And the first two chapters were called Gloom, which was about the economic crisis. And the second chapter was called Doom, which was about environmental concerns, environmental crisis, which hasn't really hit fully yet. And, you know, it may at some point, but it was really about how do we put the wheels back on the wagon and how do we come out stronger and better for all of this adversity, right? So what I talk about are a bunch of trends that have really kind of stepped up and come into play over the course of the last few years and looked at it through the lens of generational dynamics, okay? So one of the big themes that I talk about is the changing paradigms of work, okay? And how the whole definition of careers and jobs has changed several times over the course of the last three or four decades. My dad was a physicist at DuPont, and for him, the paradigm was the career ladder. You start at the bottom, you just climb straight up, and maybe you get stuck somewhere and you just sort of hang out there until you retire. But it was one organization, straight up and then down and then maybe out. Okay.
And they provided pensions for people and security, and that's one of the reasons.
You didn't have to go anywhere else. That was it. Very paternalistic organization that took care of everything for you, right?
Yeah.
And that was it. And that worked out great. And he was there for 35 years. The generation after my father's generation, the boomer generation, started exploring a different paradigm, which I refer to as the career lattice. And that's where you start at the bottom, you work your way up the top, but then you go sideways as you work for someone else for a while, and then you can continue to climb there. And they basically had to do that in response to the movement towards downsizing and outsourcing back in the 1980s and the 1990s, okay? So their children saw their parents get downsized and outsized, and their response was, you can't trust anyone anymore.
Are these Gen Xers now? Gen Xers?
We're talking, Gen Xers, going into millennials.
And some millennials,
Yeah, that kind of morphed into, I think, the current career paradigm, which really resembles more of a patchwork crazy quilt. And by that, I mean, you have people patching together a bunch of different gigs in a way that's flexible and covers their needs. Okay.
The way that you have put this together is just amazing. It's just a lot of people can't do what you do, which is just look at this macro, you know, create this sense from it,
it's
so to speak.
Very left brain, very right brain, all at the same time.
Working together.
You got to do it all, you know, to get the whole package. But what I find really interesting about the millennials is that they are perfectly adapted to an environment of economic uncertainty, and that they are what I refer to as the first generation of post-consumers. And I say that because they're not buying anything, okay? They're not buying houses. They're not necessarily buying cars.
She's so sensible, and so, you know, it's like they're saving, and they're, you know, she already bought an apartment, and she's like 24, you know?
Well, she's going to be resilient because, you know, they realize that if you have a variable income, right, if you're doing gig work, if you're a writer, if you're subcontracting, if your income goes up and down every month and you don't even know where your next paycheck is coming from, you can't commit to long-term debt, okay? You know, you can't take out a mortgage if you don't know how much money is coming in at the month. So you really need to adapt your lifestyle in a way that you have variable expenses to you know, back up your variable income. Okay?
Right, the economic reality. Right.
That's the economic reality. So it's it's gotten to the point where if you ask the average millennial how long they plan to stay at their current career, it's typically about 2 to 3 years, and that's
right.
And
so
if they get laid off, they can deal with it. They moved on. Yeah. You know, the key there is to network before you need it, to realize that friends and family and colleagues are the new Social Security. Okay.
Yeah.
And you need to build that network so you can plan your next move, so that you know where you're going next.
Oh, wow. So I'm just, you know, just bowled over by how you process information and put it together into this coherent theory. Would you mind taking that resilience that we talked about and shifting it now towards in what way it might be related to the creative process? Because I've been doing some thinking about that. I would love to hear what you think.
Yeah, so I think one of the keys of resilience is being a generalist, sort of a jack of all trades, being able to look at the world through multiple lenses with multiple skill sets, okay?
And see connections,
And to see connections and to look at the fringe between some of these worldviews and some of these disciplines, right? So during a period of economic expansion and economic certainty, it pays to specialize, and that is to get really good at just one thing. During a period of instability, you need to be good at a lot of things, okay? You need to be more of a generalist so that you can switch your game to keep up with the changing times, okay?
Right.
So in my work, I'm a futurist, but I started out as a financial person, okay? In the course of working on my book, I also learned how to write. I also learned how to speak and, you know, pick up, you know, a few other of these skill sets. And I kind of reached the conclusion that fortune favors the flexible, okay? And that you're going to be able to take on some of these new opportunities only if you're prepared when they come. So at one level, you know, successful people in a lot of cases look a little ADD because they're all over the place. But that enables them to be flexible to respond appropriately when these opportunities come up.
Got it. So resilience and flexible kind of go hand in hand. But what about this other quality of stick-to-itiveness? You know, staying the course. Does that, is that antithetical to this, or is it related in some way?
Well, yeah, it's kind of keeping your eye on the prize and also being true to who you are at the same time, and not compromising your own vision and not compromising your personal definition of happiness, okay? And it's gotten a little bit harder and a little bit more personalized because in the age when we all worked for someone else, you had that external validation. You had your, you know, career review, you had your boss saying, good job, these are the targets that you need to hit, this is what you need to do. And since people started working for themselves, right, they don't get that validation anymore. And it all has to come from inside. How am I doing relative to what I want to achieve? Right. So you really have to tune into that.
Yeah. The results you get is your validation, right?
Right.
Yeah. So one of the things that I found is, I think resilience is integrally related to the creative process. That is to say, anything that you want to bring forward that doesn't exist is creative, right? And focus and taking action, you know, a focused attention and taking action. And I don't think that they're opposed to each other, because resilience implies the flexibility, you know, that you could shift or, you know, but still you can keep your focus, take action, even if you have to shift course. Just being able to kind of see the bigger picture, I guess, another way to put it, right?
And bounce back. That's another big part.
There you go.
You know?
Bounce back. Yeah. That's it. Because a lot of people can also give up, you know, if things are not going the way they thought or want, and then they can just abandon ship, right?
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about your process in terms of what motivated you to write Resilience, and what was that like writing that book, and what advice do you have to get your message out there?
Yeah. So there's this Japanese term, I hope I get the word right, it's ikiguru, which is sort of the four components of being happy. And that is finding work that you're good at, work that the world needs, work that people are willing to pay for, okay? And what I did when I started the book, because I had a few books in mind, and I kind of put it out there on a Survey Monkey saying, hey, what do you want me to write about, okay?
Brilliant.
And I sort of crowdsourced that, and I let my friends and family make that decision for me because I didn't know what to do.
Knew you wanted to write something.
I just knew I wanted to write something. I had a non-compete agreement in my own career transition, which said I had to do something, and it wasn't what I was doing. So I had 18 months to write. And, you know, the question was, do I write about resilience and about the economic crisis, or do I write about, I was going to call it the investor's playbook. In other words, what do you do if this happens in the market versus that happens in the market? And those were the competing ideas that I had. And resilience really, I think, struck a chord. And subsequently, you know, beyond the book, it's enabled me to travel. It's enabled me to speak, develop new relationships, and, you know, coach my own clients as they go through their own personal reinventions as well.
Let alone what you learned as a result of writing it, because that's what we also do. You know, we learn a lot just by going deep into the subject.
Right. Right. Yeah, there's definitely this period of immersion with writing that I really enjoy, and that is just living with the material, digging deep in as you can. And then you kind of got to set it aside for a little bit, let it cook, let it simmer. And then I think subconsciously your mind does a lot of organization behind the scenes so that when it's ready, it's like a download. It just hits and you just start typing and things come out, and it's kind of amazing.
That is amazing what you just said, because you just essentially, you know, explain the creative process in terms of the research that I did. I didn't use the word dig deep, but it's the same thing. You immerse yourself into something and you start, you know, I actually equate the creative process to the hero's journey. You start in your ordinary world, but you accept the call, and that means digging deep. And then when you do that, this, you call it simmering, and I call it incubation.
Right.
It incubates.
Right, right.
It just stays. Mm-hmm. And it definitely, behind the scenes, you know, I call it the creative unconscious, or you're partnering with the unconscious as a partner in your creating. And then from there emerges this inspiration, you know, that it's really amazing how it works. That's what I found. And you just said the same thing, but in different words, that it just blows my mind, right? So that's the question. Did you work every day at it? How did you do it? Like, what was your process? Because a lot of people, they want to write a book, but most of them don't end up writing it.
Yeah, so my book took exactly a year to write, and my plan was to do 5 pages a week, you know, pretty doable. And the actual process was kind of like curating a collection of stories and ideas, and then stitching those stories together in a way that supported the overall narrative and the vision of what I was trying to do.
So
that was sort of it. And some tools that I use for that, Visual Mind for mind mapping. I also use Microsoft Notes now as a way of creating my own digital notebook for things. And sort of figuring out what the story is that you want to tell. Now, as a futurist, it's a little different for me than it would be for other people, to the extent that I tell stories about things that haven't happened yet, a small fraction of which might actually be true. So at any given time, I don't know if I'm writing fiction or nonfiction. You know, there's no way of footnoting things that people haven't actually said. And it is all a bit speculative. And I think people understand that. Because in the end, we're all kind of making up the future as we go along. It's kind of a choose-your-own-adventure. And you might remember those books from the 80s where if you want to go climb a tree, you go to page 32. If you want to go face the tiger, you go to page 64. And the outcome is going to be different based upon your choices. And that's kind of what the future is all about. You've got a range of choices. And ideally, you want to be able to look down the road and see the implications of those choices before you actually make a decision.
So one of the things that's critical about what you're saying is that people need to understand that they have a range of choices. And essentially, you go in and choose. And I think that's the proactive aspect of this that's very important to remember and not forget. But what struck me about what you said is, what's the story? That's what we do when we write fiction. We're trying to identify what the story is. And you had said it's like stitching together stories, because, of course, that is the way that the psyche responds to information, if it's story form, to a certain extent.
Right. Right. And understanding who you are in your own story. Right. Mm-hmm.
There you go. When are you going to start writing some science fiction? You sound like
It gets very blurry sometimes, you know, between foresight and fiction. And I know some science fiction guys that write, you know, pretty good scenarios. I don't think I'm imaginative enough to do science fiction, to be honest with you. But I've got a niche and I'm having a lot of fun with it. So project that I'm working on right now is called Foresight Investing. And it's about looking for patterns that are persistent and predictive. And those patterns appear in cycles, they appear in systems, they appear in numbers, and they appear in charts. So that's my current project.
So I'd love to actually, you know, kind of finish off with that. What are you doing now, and what's the future look like for you, and what are you, you know, so Foresight Investing, and how can people benefit from your work and you know, kind of connect with you?
Sure. So I am a active investment manager and financial planner. The address for my website is www.stratfi.com. It stands for Strategic Foresight Investments. And I manage money for people who are interested in what happens next. So a lot of different systems and strategies that I've built at this end to deal with market volatility, which seem to be doing really pretty well. So I'm quite happy about that. I also do speaking and writing as well. So lots of different ways of connecting and having a conversation.
And you're also a blogger with the World Future Society? And you still do that?
Now that organization has changed around a little bit, so I don't blog for them presently, but I do have a newsletter that I send out every month talking about emerging themes in finance and the markets. And to get on that list, all you have to do is email me at jlee@stratfi.com.
Lovely. And so if you don't mind me asking one final question, where do you see the market going? Do you mind the soundbite on that?
You know, I was telling someone this morning, I think that the market went full Monty Python today. And I don't know whether it's from The Life of Brian or Monty Python and the Holy Grail, but there was a line that says, the beatings will continue until morale improves. And that's kind of the mode that we're in right now. I mean, just looking at this as a market technician, you know, technical analyst, the market did break through some pretty critical support lines. It looks like it's going to be pretty choppy sailing. It felt like this pullback came a little earlier than I was expecting, but I was ready for it, and I have systems in place now to manage volatility. So, you know, we're going to get through this fine.
Exactly. The bottom line is that, you know, things have a cyclicality to them, and so there always is going to be some kind of shift, but it's, you know, long term. If you look at the long term, it always pays to just keep investing.
It does. It does. Absolutely.
And the last thing you want to do is pull out right before a downturn, because you get...
Well, you have this relationship in the long-term trends look like cycles, and in the short-term cycles look like trends. So there's definitely this yin-yang relationship between the two. And depending upon your focus, kind of picks the strategy that you want to follow.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, what I meant to say is the last thing you want to do is pull out after you see a major downturn just because you're scared.
Exactly.
That's what I meant to say, not what I said before.
That is correct. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been incredibly enlightening, and you really are, this is amazing. So just keep on keeping on, and I hope everyone enjoyed this as much as I did. Jim Lee, and we'll sign off for now. Thank you so much.
So much fun. Let's do it again. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.
The Creative Writer's Way.
To touch the reader inside is to tap into where we live. It is common to us all. It is unique to us all. Finding that path is the hero's journey. The journey begins with you.
This is Dr. Skylar Madison. Find your story at skylarmadison.com.